are grateful for the wonderful opportunity that we have to assemble ourselves and examine history from the divine perspective, which is the only way to understand history accurately and to make and to draw the proper conclusions that are applicable to the time in which we live. How grateful we are, Father, for your word that tells us and describes for us your essence and the manner in which your Son does control history. To this end, then, Father, we pray in Christ's name. Amen. I certainly do not want to belabor any period of history, but you just have to understand that this period of history is, to me, some of the most interesting, dynamic period of all human history. There is so much that is going on in history during the time period that we're studying. And what we're going to do tonight is we are going to finish up the Persian Empire. Now, obviously, you understand when you study history, there are a lot of other things going on. And so, for an example, while we're over here, let me see, because I'm going to need these tonight. The rapture hasn't occurred, but just a moment. All right. Grady made these things up, and they are very good. And so I want to, let's see, this is the Sinai, so we don't need that. This is Asia Minor, Persia, Mesopotamia. Okay, that'll be a good one for right now. This side up. Boy, he really wrote, only that's Palestine. I won't need that tonight. Okay. Okay, this side. Okay. And what we're going to need is this one right here will be the best one, I guess, for what I want to talk about. All right. What we have, what we're studying in our study, of course, as you know by now, is the Persian Empire. Now, the Persian Empire, here's Babylon, and so you come over into to the Persian area. In fact, tonight we're going to study a battle that took place right here, but this is the Persian Empire, all of this over here. Now, you move on across here, and right in here, by the way, is where Colossae is, that we'll be noting tonight. And then you move on across the Aegean Sea, and you've got all of Greece over here. Now, what we're finishing up in our study is the Persian Empire. This empire, all this empire, well, it goes all the way over, involves Palestine, Egypt for a while, all the way over, and includes Greece. But what I'll do, we'll start next Sunday night, or maybe tonight, but I doubt it, because I just want to have package type of classes in this thing, because I don't want you to be too confused. And also what I want to do are to bring you broad things that you can grab hold of, things that occurred in history, because there's too much to grasp at all. I appreciate your interest in even coming to this class when we're studying things like this, and I want you to have a control and an understanding of it. So the best way to do it, rather than like right now tonight, stop and go through Athens and Sparta and why they're fighting and the Peloponnesian Wars and all of that. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to relate it as it relates to Persia. And then what we will do is in one class, hopefully, we can bring together about 1,000 years of Greece history, the history of Greece, and show you why you have all of the various divisions and regions in the area of Greece and all of the peoples that make up that area, and how they're so different, their language, their cultures, and why they never really got together. And it will not be until Philip, the father of Alexander, and Alexander himself, who will bring it together. But the reason that they will be able to is because of what Persia will do in these in the class tonight, and how Persia will actually cause the Greek states over here to finally pull together in a confederate and to fight and to join together. And it isn't going to last all that long, and it'll be divided up. But in the total period of its history, some of the great minds, and what I want to do is just kind of go through with you the development of Greek history, Greek culture, Aristotle, Socrates, Demosthenes, when all these people occurred, the Helen of Troy story, and just kind of put it into a framework for you. And as far as I'm concerned, if you go back and forth and back and forth, you get confused, and I don't want you to be confused. So right now we're studying Persia, and we're going to finish the rise and fall of Persia, and then we will go over, and you'll see where these things fit in when we come to the study of the study of Greece. So very quickly now, we've had to miss a couple of weeks. We're studying the rise and fall of Persia. You recall the first great leader, Cyrus the Great, and 559 to 530, and he was the one who ushered in or allowed the Jews to return to their land after he conquered Babylon in 539. Then the second king was Cambyses the Second, and Cambyses conquered Egypt. Cambyses conquered Egypt. He's the son of Cyrus, 530 to 522. 530 to 522. And then you recall we have the all-time jerk of Persian rule, Pseudo-Smerdis, and he ruled for just a few months in 522. Then we have the fourth ruler was Darius the First, and he was the one, you recall, who fell to Greece. He was the one, and you just kind of think through history. If you can't remember names, you want to remember Cyrus and you want to remember Darius. And Cyrus was the ruler of Persia, and he decided what he wanted to do was, let's see, this is Babylon here, and this is the city-state of Ur, where Abraham was from. So you have Ur, and then you have Babylon here, and then Nineveh up in this area. Now, what he decided to do, and by the way, they rule from Susa, which is over on this side of the Mesopotamia Valley. Well, he decided that he needed to control this area, which we know as Greece, the Hellenistic area, in order to stop invasion of coming across and to control the Western world. And that's why he went up and invaded Greece. But you'll recall that he was sent back, and he was defeated by the Greeks in the Battle of Marathon in 490. Then that brings us to the next ruler, the son of Darius the First, and that is Xerxes, X-E-R-X-E-S, son of Darius the First, 486 to 465. Now, you'll recall, and we studied all of these things in regard to Xerxes. And Xerxes is the one who was talked into by his staff to go up and to avenge the defeat of the Greeks, of his father by the Greeks. And so he charged up there and decided to take that advantage. And then you'll recall that he met with great defeat. And that's where we had to leave off at that time. So let's continue now with our study. And that was at the Battle of Plataea in 479 B.C. So that was in 479 B.C. I was in the bookstore a couple of weeks ago before Christmas, I guess, and looking for a certain book and dealing with the history of Greece, and just happened to get a workman at the store who was history buff, and we had quite a lot of fun just talking about. I was surprised, I think we were both kind of surprised, that we've understood some things in regard to just this section of history, and we had some various ideas about it and enjoyed it very much. But in the Battle of Plataea, he was defeated. Now that brings us to our study tonight. And if you have your notes, you have point five. And the Persians were in excellent position. Well, that point five was how they lost the battle. So and we ended with the point that this was the beginning of the decline of the great Persian Empire. Now that's just the beginning. It's going to take quite a while, as a decline of an empire always does. Now we're back under Xerxes to major point nine. Now, I hope that your notes are in good shape, that that makes sense to you. Does that make sense to anyone? All right, few say yes, few say no. Well, if you go back and look at your notes, you have major point eight was war against the Greeks. That was major point eight, and then we took up the various battle. But point one, he was a son of Darius and Atasa, who was the daughter of Cyrus the Great. Point two, Darius died in 486. Xerxes became the ruler. Point three, once he became sole ruler of the empire, he abandoned the policy of tolerance started by Cyrus and followed set up the standard for developing an empire. Point four, in 484, 2 years after he began his rule, he led his army into Egypt and subjugated Egypt to Persian rule. Point five, he then returned to Babylon only to put down rebellions in Babylon. Point six, he changed the rule to the Persian Empire. Point seven, Xerxes' religion. We studied his religion. And then point eight were the war with the Greeks, which he lost. Now you're ready for major point nine. And major point nine, after the defeat at the Battle of Plataea, P-L-A-T-A-E-A, and what I want to do is occasionally, we will not do it tonight, in any detail, but what I didn't do last 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks, whatever it's been, that I want to start doing, you go through and you study these wars, sometimes we will, the maneuvering of troops and all. I want that to make sense to you, and what we're going to start doing is drawing some spiritual applications and some fun applications as far as life is concerned. That's one of the advantages. If you were to involve your children in this type of thing, and there are all kinds of games that are out now in war, but they should be learning about things about life, and you can learn a great deal from various battles about life. I went back and developed some, but I'm not going to go over that tonight. All right, let's move on now. Major point nine, after the defeat of the Battle of Plataea in 479, Xerxes returned to Persia. Xerxes returned back to Persia. And in 479, the story of Esther occurred. Now, Esther of the Bible, the story of Esther is going to occur. Esther becoming queen, taking the place of the queen of Xerxes. And so that's when this will occur, after the defeat. And he came back, when you understand it in this perspective, the former queen probably was very arrogant and she probably had lost respect for Xerxes. You recall from our study, outline study of Esther, how she was very arrogant with her friends and just refused to come in and dance, which was the custom, and not in the nude, but to come in and to dance and to for the king to present the woman that he loved. And she was telling the women, you recall, how really great she was, and she didn't have to obey him. Well, she was wrong. And he just dismissed her and set out on a beauty contest. And that's when Esther was discovered. And so we studied that, and we will go over some principles. A very interesting class that we've got coming up in a study of the Shulamite woman who would not, shall we say, dance for the king. And Queen Esther, who did dance for the king. And some parallels, remarkable parallels. You take a circumstance in the life of two ladies, and they're both right, and they both did just the opposite. And it's a quite interesting study from that standpoint of two women and the decisions that they make. But we'll come to all of that in its proper place in Song of Solomon. In March of 474 B.C., all the Jews in Persia were to be executed, you recall. And that's when Xerxes, through various people like Mordecai, the friend of Esther, and delivered the Jews from that anti-Semitic movement. And King Xerxes did not execute all of the Jews. And then major point 10, in December of 465, Xerxes died. In December of 465, Xerxes died, and that brings us now to the next ruler of Persia, and that is Artaxerxes, A-R-T-A-X-E-R-X-E-S, Artaxerxes. The study of the world, both in ancient history and modern history, is a study of people, and you have to realize that, and we'll see it tonight in a little while. in regard to Paul, the Apostle Paul. God uses people. And even in the day when we have invisible impact, God uses people. I was talking to a good friend of mine last week, had some people staying at my house, and had taken a course at Georgia Tech, and it was the history of Europe from 1890 to the present, and they had to, their final exam was to pick out the 10 most important people of Europe, and by important, people who had an impact, a decisive impact in history, and we had a wonderful time for a couple of hours just going over some of the people just of Europe during that time period. So people form the study of history, and that's why understanding people becomes so important in life. Of course, arrogant people never will understand that. All right, Artaxerxes, let me just, we always like to start with his dates. He will rule from 465 to 423. 465 to 423 B.C. And just when you start thinking of Artaxerxes, you start thinking of declining years of the Persian Empire. It'll have a few brief things that will occur, but these are the declining years. I've just got a few things we want to note about Artaxerxes. Point one, during his reign, some very important events will occur in Jewish history. Very important events of Jewish history will occur under the rule of Artaxerxes, 465 to 423. In fact, somewhere around 425 is the writing of the last book of the Old Testament. So Artaxerxes is the ruler during some very important events in Israel's history. And you remember that from the standpoint that while Israel moves over here, they're still under the dominance and the power and the rule of Persia. Now, Persia will allow various regions to somewhat rule themselves, but they have their armies and taxes and different things that will occur here in in Greece, Egypt, all over the Persian Empire. They have their staffs, armies, and various dignitaries that will rule everything. Now, point two, the Greeks refer to Artaxerxes as long hand. Just long hand. Apparently he was a very big man or very big hands. And in Latin, he is therefore known as Longiminus, meaning the long hand. Point three, he was the younger son of Xerxes. Four, he was placed on the throne as the ruler by military commander of his father. Now, I'll give you his name. His name was Artabanus, A-R-T-A-B-A-N-U-S. But you want to remember, the name isn't important right now. You want to remember the events that occur in history. And Artabanus, who was a military ruler of his father Xerxes, appointed the youngest son to rule, thinking that he could control him. Therefore, point five, soon thereafter, Artabanus, the man who appointed Artaxerxes, murdered Xerxes. In other words, Artaxerxes' father. So he murdered Xerxes. He appointed Xerxes' son, and as soon as his son is appointed, then he murders the king or the ruler, the father. Artaxerxes, the son who is now ruler and a young man, killed Artabanus in hand-to-hand combat. Now, you'll find this occurring in history because this happened now, and the man who will kill Alexander the Great's father, Alexander will just walk up with a long knife, and slaughter him. So you'll find these types of things going on in history at various times, and we'll come to Alexander in a little while. But so the man appoints the younger son, Artaxerxes, kills his father. Artaxerxes comes back and kills him. What am I doing? That's what's happening in Persia. One thing you can always tell when a nation is on its decline, and I'll show you tonight, But just, I want you to, in this class, not only learn history, learn to understand and learn from history. The rule and how and what type of quality of people are ruling and what the inconsistency in rule. All of this leads to inconsistency in the land. And then taxes, increasing in taxes. There are a lot of things that happen when a nation's on its way down. And believer, this is true across the board, ancient history, all the way through church age to modern history. And it just describes what's happening in our country to the point. But it just one some of those things. You can just see it in all nations that these type of things let you know that you're headed for some real trouble with these type of things occur. Point six. Artaxerxes' rule was marked by uprisings from various regions that he ruled, including Egypt. So he had to deal with more and more people uprising, loss of respect, people not going to pay tribute that they were required to pay. All of these things that we're experiencing in our own country today, where we have very little respect around the world for America. And all people really want from America now is our money. And very little respect in the way that they think, act, and deal with America. All of these things lets you know what's happening in America. Now, in our arrogance, in our pride, in our zeal, we want to say, well, to Hades with the world. You know, they don't like us, fine. We're still powerful. Well, see, that I understand that from a patriotic standpoint, but you have to realize why. What's happening in the world? What's happening to America? What's happening to America's place in the world? That causes small countries, large countries, all this various attitudes about our country to start changing and shifting. And I'm just showing you, it doesn't take a prophet, it doesn't take much to realize this country's headed for trouble. And whether it happens in 1992 or I got to talk to Bob, and maybe even sooner by his observations of history, and just a lot of things. But whenever it comes, it's no surprise. You can just look at our country's history and what's happening and learn from history. We're headed for great trouble. Point seven, in reference to Israel. Now, during the reign of Artaxerxes in Israel, Ezra and his party set out for Judah in 457. Now, we've studied all of this, but I just want you to put it now into the time frame of what's happening in Persia. The Persians have lost a battle with Greece. Things are happening in Persia. Esther has become queen. A lot of things are going on. Anti-Semitism has been put down for a while. And then in 457, Ezra is allowed to go to Jerusalem. He arrives in Jerusalem in July. Remember Nehemiah who asked the king if he could go, asked Artaxerxes if he could go. Artaxerxes said, yes, are you coming back? Nehemiah said, yes, I will come back. He went to Jerusalem. The enemies of the Jews sent word, Nehemiah's not coming back, and Nehemiah hurried back up. And so you have Nehemiah leaves during the period of 440, during the year of 444, March 444, and the completion of the walls of Jerusalem in the same year. Nehemiah returns to Persia as he promised, and then he is allowed to return to Jerusalem. And shortly after Nehemiah is allowed to return to Jerusalem, Artaxerxes dies in 425 B.C., somewhere around 425 B.C. Point eight. The decline of the Persian Empire dates from this man's rule. The real decline of the Persian Empire dates from this man's rule. The Athenian Athens, the city of Athens, the Athenian fleet dominated the Mediterranean and nearly all of the land that Persia once ruled. They do not have the control that they had. Now, they still have some control and influence, but not as much as they had. Now we come to the declining years of the Persian influence. And now, just to get it in perspective, 425, I want you to think into the shiftings of powers and everything that's going on. Now, we're here in 425. We're at 425 B.C. Artaxerxes dies. The Persian Empire is declining. Now, just remember that we're going to come down to around 330, 340, 338. We're going to have Alexander the Great coming up on the scene of history. So what's happening in Greece is a rise as the great Persian Empire declines, but both of these are having direct effect on the client nation of God of Israel. Now, the next king is Darius II. Darius II, son of Artaxerxes I. Darius II, son of Artaxerxes, and we just studied. Darius is his son by a mistress. He seized the throne. I want you to see how unstable Persia is. He seized the throne from his half-brother, whom he then executed. And this gets into an excellent study of rulers of nations, what happens between families, what happens in nations, in national history. His name, that is Darius II, his real name is Ochus, O-C-H-U-S. But he adopted the name of Darius when he began his reign. He was also known as Nothus, N-O-T-H-U-S. And that word means, in quotes, bastard. I don't know that they called him that to his face. I don't think they came up and said, "Hail Nothus." And I think they probably left that for the barracks talk and other places. But he will rule from 423 to 404. His reign was characterized by weakness and corruption. Now, I want to make a statement. I pointed out that he is an illegitimate son. Not all illegitimate children in history have bad impacts or a bad character. There are some very strong and powerful leaders in human history who were illegitimate children, a couple who are in the line of our Savior and the genealogy of Christ. This just fits into the entire momentum. He couldn't handle it. He changed his name, and you can just see the total instability. And psychiatrists would have had a lot of fun with him today. But this type of thing's been going on for a long time. Instability, insecurity. So he changed his name. His rule was marked by corruption and weakness. He was run by his wife. He was run by his wife, who was cruel and ambitious. Now, I want to, the next paragraph that I want to give you is Persia and Greece during his reign. Just as I gave you what was happening in Israel under the reign of Artaxerxes, let's go over a few things that were happening between the relationship of Persia and Greece during his reign. Now, there's a lot going on in Greece. I'm just concerned with Persia and Greece, just that part of the Hellenistic history. All right, let's note a few things. After Athens was defeated at Syracuse, S-Y-R-A-C-U-S-E, in 413, and that's very important. Athens was defeated. The city-state of Athens was defeated at Syracuse in 413. Darius, that's our king, Darius II, decided to recover the Greek coastal cities of Asia Minor, which had been under the control of Athens since 448 B.C., Athens gave Persia a great deal of trouble. You can kind of remember that if you want to. There's a lot to kind of bear in mind, and even when we get to Greece, I'm going to try to pull out the main things. But Athens gave Persia a great deal of trouble. Now, continuing, Persian gold was used to incite wars. In fact, an alliance was made against Athens with the city-state of Sparta, with Sparta, S-P-A-R-T-A. And this will involve the great Peloponnesian Wars. Now, don't be frightened of the word. Peloponnesian War, P-O-N-N-E-S-I-A-N, Peloponnesian Wars. We're going to study the Peloponnesian Wars, but you know all they are, just to give you the bottom line so that you can understand and not feel intimidated. You hear the word Peloponnesian Wars? It's a war between Athens and Sparta. It's the wars between the war between Athens and Sparta. We will study them. And so we'll come to all of these to these battles. In fact, the Peloponnesian Wars will date somewhere around 438 to 404, somewhere in that time frame. Now, while all of this is going on, Darius II appointed his son, now you want to remember this name, his son, Cyrus the Younger. Cyrus the Younger, to take charge of Greece. Cyrus the Younger, by the way, will bivouac in Colossae, which will be the target of the book of Colossians that we're about to study. So Cyrus the Younger, the son of Darius II, is placed in charge of the Greek negotiations, and he has given him a large sum of money in gold to rebuild the Spartan fleet. As a result, the Athenian power was broken in approximately 405, 404 BC, depending on the historian. 405, 404 BC, Athens falls. Now, all of that's important in getting ready for Philip of Macedon, because we're down in the southern area of Greece, and they're fighting and all of this, going at each other's throat. And a man's going to come out of Macedon, up north, named Philip, and who will begin things. All right, and I'll go through some of the things that different people had to say about Philip, the father of Alexander. Now, while concentrating, we're still dealing with point one, still dealing with the point of Persia and Greece relationships. While concentrating on Greece, Persia continued to lose its influence in the remainder of the world. The Medes will rebel. Egypt will rebel. There will be attacks of anti-Semitism in Palestine. Various forces will come in and slaughter or kill the Jews. And Persia is unable to do anything about it, though they would have liked to, and though that was their intention, they just simply were unable to do anything about it. Darius will die of disease in 404. And that brings us to the next king under the decline of Persia. The second king, first king under the decline, is Darius II. Now we come to point the second one, Artaxerxes II. And just put ATX the second. Artaxerxes II. His reign will be from 404 to 359, 358, whichever. And Alexander's father now is moving to power. Philip up in Macedon is now. I just want you to kind of feel everything, the dynamics of this period of history. It really is exciting. And I could really blow your mind if we wanted to go over and bring in what's happening in the East, but we'll not do that. All right. Let's take a look now at Artaxerxes II. His reign will be from 404 to 359, 358. He was the son of Darius II and called by the Greeks
Mnemon, M-N-E-M-O-N, which means mindful.
Now, to show you again the inconsistency of the empire, an attack was made on his life during his incarnation ceremony by his own brother. So we're back to the Cain and Abel story. Brothers and sisters, wonderful. Love of the family, and it's all just really wonderful. All right? I wouldn't trust my brother either. All right? So he is at his coronation. He is, an attack is made on his life by his own brother, get it down, Cyrus the Younger. So Cyrus the Younger, who you'll recall that the father had put in charge of the problems in Greece, tries to kill Artaxerxes II. Now Artaxerxes' mother, now that's that wicked woman who had a great influence on her husband, Artaxerxes II, his mother pleaded with him to pardon his brother and to pardon Cyrus the Younger for what he did. He will do so. Cyrus the Younger will then go out and form an army and lead a rebellion against his own brother. Now, before I get to that, because that's a fun part of history, but let's just go and take in a few things now. When Artaxerxes II, and you, as I said, just put down A-R-T-X, Artaxerxes II, when he assumed the Persian throne, Athens had fallen in the Peloponnesian War, and here are the correct dates, I was a little off, 431 to 404. 431 to 404. And just remember that this is a struggle in ancient Greece between Athens and Sparta, and the result of the Peloponnesian War was the fall of Athens. And with the fall of Athens, you have an increase in the influence of Persia. With the fall of Athens, you have an increase in the influence of Persia in Greece. Now, in 404... Artaxerxes II will lose Egypt. They will rebel, and he cannot stop it. That's 404. So he's got some strong influence. Just kind of feel what's happening in history. He has some strong influence. He has some strong influence over here, but he's lost his influence here. He's losing his influence here. And as we'll see, all of this area over here, Iran, and what we know as Iran and Iraq, Mede area up here, all of these are now going to slowly rebel against his rule. And you're seeing at this time in history a weakening of this whole area. It's just going to become unimportant as we move into Western civilization. And with the rise of Greece and then, of course, Rome and all of this, these areas really are losing in their importance of history. All right, now. 404, Artaxerxes II loses Egypt. Now, in 401 B.C., Cyrus the Younger formed an army made up of Spartan mercenaries. Now, remember, he was over in that area for a great deal of time. Let's see if we have a map here now just of Greece. Let's see, Goshen and the Sinai, we don't need that. Yes, here's one, and we'll put that up here. This is the only problem with these maps. They're nice, but you get too many of them. All right, now, Cyrus the Younger, by the way, if we were looking at this, Colossae is going to be right in here, our study tonight. And we have Hell's Point up here. But Cyrus the Younger has been all in this area now, administrating for his father, been over here in Colossae. In fact, he was in Colossae for a while. And so Cyrus the Younger, the brother of Artaxerxes II, in 401, formed an army made up of Spartan mercenaries to go against his brother. And therefore, the famous battle of Cunica. About two ways that I found that it can be pronounced, C-U-N-A-X-A.
And it's pronounced a K-O-O-N and then a C-E. This is famous for two reasons. This battle is famous for two reasons. The reason, by the way, where is it? All right, if we have to go back now to one of our other maps here. Let's see, we'll go back to this one, and I'll show you where this area is. Kunha is located. This is the city of Ur. This is Babylon. And this is the Tigris River. This is the Euphrates River. See, this is the Euphrates River. This is the Tigris River. It's located right up here, right outside of Babylon. Right in this area is where this battle is going to take place. Now, what happened was Cyrus the Younger brought his mercenaries over, came up. There's a port town here, and they have marched down all the way down the Mesopotamia Valley, and here we are ready to attack his brother, Artaxerxes II, to resume the throne, take control of the throne. And history has it that if Cyrus the Younger had a larger army and could have won this battle, that it may have changed the flow of history for a while. But just remember, Jesus Christ is in control of history. But Cyrus the Younger was a much better leader, stronger individual, more powerful individual than his brother, but always out taking care of other things and didn't get the throne. All right, 401, Cyrus the Younger forms an army made up of Spartan mercenaries to go again. Remember, the Spartans are the ones who are friends of the Persians against the Athenians. Just start, if I repeat things, you'll start learning them almost whether you want to or not. And that way you'll feel familiar with Greek history. All right, and the famous battle, and it's famous for two reasons. First of all, it's famous in reference to Persia. It marked the time when the world realized just how weak Persia really was. It told the world how fractioned and weak the Persian Empire really was. And secondly, it is very important and very famous because out of this will emerge the great military personnel, Xenophon. X-E-N-O-P-H-O-N-A, Xenophon. And Xenophon will lead that famous retreat of the 10,000 Spartans. He will lead the famous retreat of the 10,000 Spartans. Now, how they will do this, if you look at the map, they will leave the battlefield, they'll go up the valley, they come up here, and then they got a lot of mountain area, and they'll go across the mountain area. And they are going to be attacked all the way across, getting up here to the Black Sea, and then get back over to their own land, come back down around over into Sparta, into Greece. But they are going to be chased, pursued by the Persian army. They will be attacked by various guerrilla mountaineers in this area, and they will have opposition all the way through. Xenophon is going to write one of the first great books on military strategy, and a lot of things are going to change that are going to help Alexander the Great later on, who will read Xenophon. And Xenophon is a military soldier. He was caught in the middle of all of this. He was a Greek mercenary. And the leaders, after Cyrus the Younger was killed, Xenophon, and then the other officers were killed, Xenophon was chosen to lead. And he will improvise some of the traditional warfare. He will improvise, come up with some new things, and put it all together. And then he goes home and writes all of this. And puts it down. And a lot of things are going to happen out of this war. Now, let me just give you a few facts about the battle. The battle occurred in 401 B.C. We don't really have that many battle plans of it, so I'm not going to get into even what we do have. The commanders, Artaxerxes II, ruler of the Persian Empire, versus Cyrus the Younger, his own brother, who is trying to become ruler of the Persian Empire. As far as their armies, Artaxerxes II's army is composed of 30,000 foot soldiers and 6,000 horse soldiers. Now, the military highlight. It clearly demonstrated for the future, like Alexander the Great, future generals, that the lightly armed troops of the Persian Empire were too strong, no match really, for the Greek heavy infantry. In other words, the Greeks at this time, up to now, were heavy infantry, heavy laden with material, artillery, armor, all kinds of things that they were given. And they just were no match for the Persian light infantry. Just no match whatsoever. By the way, a word that you might come across if you ever do any reading and in this period of history is the word hoplite, H-O-P-L-I-T-E. That is a word that means, that describes a Greek soldier, heavy, uniformed soldier, infantryman. That's what the word means. And the Persians were very light. Light infantrymen, doesn't mean light in their own way, but light in what they had to carry. And from this we have a development of the light army. And let me just give you some of these things so you can start learning and thinking in the area of the development of warfare and things that were learned by Xenophon at this battle. Because up to now, the Greeks have been very heavy because of the type of battles that they would do, very close, and they had all come out with all of this armor and everything on, and very heavy infantrymen, and they would just stand there and fight it all out because of they didn't have the mass space that you have is going to be required in other battles. So Xenophon came up and realized the following, that the light infantrymen, one, can inflict wounds at a long range, bows and arrows, slingshots, this type of thing. Many of these things will be developed by Rome. And it's just fun. I hope that you're interested in this, because it's fun to see why Rome so powerful, why Alexander so great, and what the things that helped him to be great, not just his own human leadership. Secondly, a light infantry can occupy high ground and move to the high ground very quickly. In other words, javelins, squad of javelins. They can move up on the high ground, take their javelins, and they're right on top of the people. Xenophon will use this. He'll learn all of this as he's retreating back up to the coastline with the 10,000 Spartans. And it really is a phenomenal reading. You ought to read, just for the fun, Xenophon's story of all of this. It has some great things in it. Thirdly, dislodging opposing troops. You can move in and dislodge the opposing troops in battle. Four, they are much better for reconnaissance. For quick reconnaissance, sending out someone in the night. Five, they're excellent for ambush. Excellent for ambush. They're light, quiet, and can attack quickly. And six, they are perfect for pursuing the broken enemy. In other words, the final stage of a battle is pursuit and destroy. And the light army is much better for pursuing and killing the enemy as they're on the run. So these are the kinds of things that are starting to develop in history. In the battle, Artaxerxes II realized that his chariots were futile, and therefore he went to his superior numbers of his light troops. Now he brought his heavy artillery, brought the chariots and all of that, but he realized early in the war that they just were not going to do the job. So he sat down and guided his light infantry, or his light infantry in the battle, and to defeat Cyrus the Younger. In fact, he formed a double envelopment. Somewhere along the line, we might have to take up a few of these military terms just for your fun and enjoyment, as we did in the study of Joshua. Fun and joy. I can see some of you. Oh, boy. And Cyrus, now reacting. Now, here's a good study of reacting under pressure. Cyrus, reacting under pressure and realizing that he was losing the battle, he gathered a group of 600 cavalry units around him, and he went after Artaxerxes, his brother, in person. I'm just going to kill him. So he decided to go after the man. He allowed his emotions to distract, and when he realized he was losing, he went after the king personally. In that confrontation, Artaxerxes was wounded, but Cyrus the Younger was killed. It just didn't work. They were just too much. wait and for the light infantry that were surrounding Artaxerxes II, and he destroyed all of them and killing Cyrus the Younger in pursuit. Study of tactics, studying of going after men, very important in history. In fact, in our own history, this is one thing that made Ulysses S. Grant so successful in closing out the war between the states. He was the first general that said, to heck with Lee, take Atlanta or Richmond, take Richmond. Forget Lee. You can't take Lee. Lee's too smart. Lee is too much of a genius in warfare. That's why this war has gone on for 4.5 years. Don't you people understand that? And so Ulysses S. Grant said, we're not going to take Lee. You're not going to take Lee. In fact, avoid Lee. Just take Richmond. Get his logistics. Cut off his supplies. An army cannot fight without supplies. And that's why he was able to end the war so quickly. In fact, he wouldn't even fight Lee. Lee would come up, if you know anything about the battle, Lee would come up in the wilderness battle. Grant would come down, and Lee would come up and meet him. Well, Grant wouldn't even fight him. Now, down here is Richmond, and Atlanta. And so he would come around, and then he would just go around him. Well, Lee would pull a swing in sweep and put up another blockade. He still wouldn't fight. If you follow this, Jim Passmore and I, you just keep driving and you just keep going around these end things until finally he goes way down here below it and he ends up at Petersburg because he just, that is the armies, and he was trying to get up here and he just kept bouncing all the way around until finally he's down here on the southern part and the army of the northern army is going to attack Richmond, but they're going to do it from the south. They're going to attack Richmond from the south. They're going to have to go through Petersburg. And all he was trying to do, but Lee just kept doing this all along the way. He didn't want to fight Lee. In fact, he refused to fight Lee because you're not going to defeat Lee. And so Ulysses S. Grant just came along. Then we had the long winter. And after the long winter, then the army just went into Richmond. And that's when Lee had to pull out of Richmond into Lee's retreat and went over to Appomattox. But the study of war and strategy and knowing what to do, and here the man decides to go after a man and he ends up getting killed in the process. You cannot lose your cool. You cannot lose your emotions. And even though you hate or whatever, you have to remain in control in the midst of battle. Well, Cyrus the Younger was killed. Xenophon was appointed leader after the death of Cyrus and other Greek generals or officers. Xenophon led the Greek mercenaries back to the Black Sea. And I've given you somewhat the route, or at least the direction. They went up the Mesopotamia Valley, and they charged up the Mesopotamia Valley. Right here again is the battle. They charged up up the valley, and then they headed up to the coastline. And this is the famous march of the 10,000 Spartans, and how they made their way up in this direction. As he made their way northward through hostile territory, up the Tigris to the Black Sea, he was pursued by the Persians, attacked by guerrilla mountaineers and other armies and cities that he had to either get close to or get involved with. Xenophon set his experience to writing in a work called The Anabasis, Anabasis, another very important book in that time in history. And if you're interested in history, an excellent book to read from a man who was right there firsthand and saw these things, and a great strategist, and a man who was very flexible and did not lose his cool. When he was given the command, he remained in stability in our training of our Rangers and airborne personnel in this country. What they will do at various stages of their training. Those of you who do not know, they will be walking through, say, a ridge area, and this is all in training, and they will be attacked. And what happens is the commander who is in charge of training these personnel will shout out a name. And he'll shout out the name, Smith, you're in charge. And in that quick, in that matter of a second, Smith all of a sudden has to start giving orders, telling everyone what to do. And this is after about 3 or 4 days without any sleep whatsoever and rotten food. And they're walking down through here, and all of a sudden the crossfire comes in, and Smith's put into command. to find out how quickly he can understand, know what's going on, give orders, give commands, and take care and say. That's why your airborne and these type and ranger are taken and put into all of the other units as commanders. They're trained in this area. This is the type of training that they do. Well, Zonophan went home and he wrote all of his work, all of the things, his experiences down in the Anabasis book of military history, in one of the most important books of military history in the ancient world. The Greeks learned, now some of the things that were learned and that will be important with Alexander the Great and Rome, the Greeks learned at this time the limitations of the hoplite body, H-O-P-L-I-T-E, that is the heavy-laden infantry soldier. The Greeks learned the limitations of the hoplite body, heavily armored infantry soldier. They also learned how good they are and when they're good, because sometimes heavy infantry are very important. But you've got to be able to control what you need on a given battle, heavy infantry or light infantry. And Zonophan started becoming aware of it, so he learned when it's advantageous, though he knew that, but when it is also to your disadvantage. Zonophan also learned the increasing value of the cavalry in battle, something that is taking its front now, something that the Hittites were aware of, and the people that will take over Greece all were descendants, or at least learned a great deal from the Hittites. But Zonophan will now begin to learn the importance of the cavalry, which will become very important in history. He learned, or Greece learned, the importance of the light missile troops, as they're called. Light missile troops, armed with bows and slings and javelins. And one of the problems with a light missile battalion is that once you fired all the arrows, what are you going to do? Well, they learned this from the soldiers of the island of Cyprus. You just pick up the arrows that are fired at you. If they didn't hit you, and you pick them up on the ground, and you always have a supply. And you can't, but see, the point is, you have to have a bow that is flexible. And this is what the Greeks did not have, but they're learning. You got to have a bow that's flexible enough to take different types of arrows. So a lot of things are beginning to be developed in warfare, and that Zonophan is becoming aware of. Javelins, how they, if you have a javelin, they have to maneuver to the high ground. That can be an advantage. That can be a disadvantage. If you're depending on the function of the javelin, they have to be on a high ground, and if you cannot get them there, you're in great trouble. Let's see. And by the way, even in his own movement, his light troops would be hemmed in by the hop lines all along the way. What he would do, if I can take a terrain, he would send out, he would have a front body here and a back body here of light infantry. And they would be soon, they're symbolized with just a lot of dots. That's light infantry when you're reading the military map. And he would have, then he would have a hoplite here, and he separated them in two. This was the rear guard, front guard, to take care of any trouble. And they would, these light ones would take the high ground, and as they would come around, because they're being attacked, they're being pursued by the Persians, and attacked by various mountain guerrillas all along the way, and all the way up, actually, toward the Black Sea. So he learned a great deal. In the march, Zonophan had to fuse, mix together, traditional warfare and innovative maneuvers. So he just decided he had to do whatever had to be done. Flexibility. And flexibility, we all know, is very important in the angelic conflict. You do not, we're not flexible in doctrine, but we're very flexible in maneuvering in the Christ-centered life. And you have to be very flexible. And they're dogma in doctrine, but there are circumstances that you have to learn to be flexible. Well, Zonophan learned all of that, and he was rather innovative in much of his several of his maneuvers that paved the way for the future. Also, at this time, the army began to think for the first time, as far as Greece history is concerned, started thinking and working together and performing together as professionals. They worked together and formed together as a professional unit, not a citizen army. A professional army, not a citizen army. In other words, a citizen army, the army of Sparta, the army of Athens, the army of Thebes, the army here, and they were citizen armies. But now, with the march of the 10,000 Spartans, they do something that has not happened in the history of Greece. They are now becoming a professional army. And Xenophon actually will promise them a great amount of money if they will get home. And so now they're thinking money, they're thinking and acting like a professional, not like I'm from Athens, I don't work with you, you're from Sparta, and I don't work with you, you're from somewhere else, and you're a Dorian, and I'm not going to work with you. So all of a sudden, in the march of the 10,000 Spartans, the professionalism of a soldier is starting to come out in the history of Greece. Now, in the other nations, this has happened. We're getting ready for the rise of Alexander. And for the first time, a concept of working together, and Alexander's going to read all of this. This army is going to start functioning as a professional army. And the divisions, the fractions that we have in this country, and tear this country apart. Because we do, we're just not acting as a nation of Americans. We act as a nation of people that are interested in our little groups. So they will start working together as a professional army. He promised them great pay. When they would get home, all the Greeks would join together in a lot of different things. Just to give you another example, they joined together in the singing of a battle song before they went into battle. This was something that everyone did not do. I believe it was the Spartans. No, it was the Athenians who would sing before they'd go into battle, and the Spartans would play an instrument before they would go into battle. And what they did, they all joined together in singing a battle song. And as they would make this march, and they would all sing, and it would bring them together. And Xenophon recorded all of these things in the march of the 10,000. In fact, Xenophon points out something rather sideline history that makes a little interesting along the way. There's always a group of camp followers. Now, a few of you know what I'm talking about. Camp followers are a group of ladies, and they're not following to serve food. And but there's always a group. Well, Xenophon records how the group of the camp followers got so caught up in the singing of the songs that they actually, in one battle, joined in the charge and got all caught up in the emotion of the battle cry and everything that was going on. And Xenophon laughed. He said it was rather interesting watching this take place. But he's learning something. He's seeing something that has never been seen in Greece history before, and that's a professional army of different Greeks from different cities coming together and fighting as an army. All of this will be brought to a head by Alexander the Great. Repercussions of the... this is the fun part. Repercussions of the rebellion by Cyrus the Younger. Very quickly, repercussions of the rebellion by Cyrus the Younger. The Greeks realized that the Persians were divided and vulnerable. They were divided and vulnerable. Skirmishes will continue until in 386, Artaxerxes II will make a peace with Sparta and establish Persian rule once again over much of Greece. Now, I hate to end, but we have some other things that are going to come up, and we're 5 minutes over. But this is going to give rise right now what's happening, just to let you know, up north in 366 B.C., we have a man coming into control named Philip. And a lot of things are starting to take place that is going to give rise to the great Greeks, Greek Empire, and our language of our Bible, the New Testament. Well, let's close in a word of prayer. And then we'll come back and study the ending stages of Persian history. And then, as I said, what I want to do is just kind of not get involved because it's just too much, but give you a feel of the development of Greece, why you had Athens and why Sparta and why Thebes and why the Dorians and who are all these people and why they never got along. And what you and I know are the plays, the tragedy, the theater, and all of that, that's all religious. That's not like us going to a theater to see a movie. That's all part of their religion. And it's very important to understand all of these things, to understand what's happening in this period of history. All right, let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we are grateful for the opportunity to observe history and to understand that all of these things are leading together to the fullness of time. the birth of Jesus Christ, the God-man coming into history, that he might take our place on the cross. And that, Heavenly Father, we can learn from history. We can learn from history in regard to the time in which we live, the manner in which nations rise and fall, and how Jesus Christ is in control. And that we, as members of the pivot, need to realize how important each one of us are to this country. Important to the stability, the continuation, the function of this nation as a client nation of God, a great privilege in history. That we will meet this challenge, Father, we pray in Christ's name. Amen.